content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is George Douglas from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. And, of course, this particular edition is dated this Friday, April 1st, 2011. The first item from the main story section of the week this week is Gaddafi vows a long war after the West intervenes. What happened? Cruise missiles and bombs rained down on Libyan dictator Muammar Gaddafi's forces this week as a coalition of U.S., French, and British warships and fighter jets interceded on behalf of rebels in the country's civil war. The American-led coalition's intervention came after the UN Security Council passed a resolution that authorized all necessary measures to protect the civilians in rebel-held towns and cities, which were under heavy bombardment from Gaddafi's tanks and warplanes as he threatened to show no mercy to his enemies. The multinational forces unleashed a barrage against Libyan air defense sites and surface-to-air missile batteries, effectively destroying his air force, and then drove back Libyan armored and infantry units massing outside the rebel stronghold of Benghazi. President Obama, who had resisted intervening in Libya for several weeks, called on Gaddafi to leave now, but said that with the successful establishment of a no-fly zone, we have averted an immediate tragedy, and U.S. forces would step back. Gaddafi said the West was in for a long war, telling his supporters, "I am here. We will not surrender." The international coalition that spearheaded the intervention, meanwhile, showed signs of internal conflict, with French President Nicolas Sarkozy and British Prime Minister David Cameron jockeying for authority once the U.S. scales down its role. Libya's rebels, meanwhile, seem to disorganized and ill-equipped to exploit the West's attack on Gaddafi's mechanized units, and they struggle simply to hold their ground. Now here's what some of the editorials had to say. President Obama was right to wait to deploy American forces, said the New York Times. With ongoing wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, Obama waited until he could be sure that France and Britain would share the responsibility and cost of enforcing international law. We'd like to know the exit strategy, however. So now the West is involved in the rebels' uprising against Gaddafi, said the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Now what? If our mission's goals are truly humanitarian, then we cannot allow this to end in a stalemate with Gaddafi still smugly sitting in his tent in Tripoli and 6.5 million Libyans in chaos. The president insists that Gaddafi needs to go, said the New York Post. But even the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Mike Mullen, has said the dictator might remain in power. So which is it? And by what constitutional authority did Obama, who once denounced imperial presidencies, unilaterally order an attack on a foreign nation? Even George W. Bush did not begin the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq without congressional resolutions specifically authorizing the use of force. Now here's what the columnists had to say. Our dithering president blew it by waiting too long to defang Gaddafi, said Jonah Goldberg in the Los Angeles Times. The rebels had the momentum when the Libyan uprising began in February, as members of the madman's government fled Tripoli because it looked as though the rebels would win. A small U.S. intervention then might have toppled Gaddafi. Instead, Obama waited for international consensus. He got his wish, the French shot first, but he gave Gaddafi time to recover and dig in. The humanitarian case for intervention was pretty clear weeks ago, said Richard Cohen in the Washington Post. And yet Obama chose to make a case both for staying out and then for going in. This Hamlet-like confusion and indecision seems to characterize his entire foreign policy, which is a muddle of incoherence. Obama often solves problems by ignoring them, acting only when he no longer has a choice. The dithering complaint is nonsensical, said Kevin Drum in MotherJones.com. Before committing U.S. forces to another country's civil war, this president carefully considered his options. When did it suddenly become a personality defect to decline to intervene in a foreign rebellion? by delaying, said Glenn Thrush in Politico.com, Obama successfully maneuvered France, Britain, the Arab League, and even the fractious UN Security Council into backing a no-fly zone. But does his strategy caution, or his strategic caution and preference for international consensus suggest wisdom or weakness? Is there a coherent set of foreign policy ideas that could be called an Obama doctrine? No one can say. Obama has left both liberals and conservatives unhappy about how he's handled Libya, and his opacity is coming back to haunt him. Well, since the Week magazine went to press last week, there has been, of course, a major speech by President Obama that happened just earlier this week. And I've pulled this particular article off the Week Internet service, the website there, because I think it's extremely relevant to this whole situation, and it might help provide a little bit of clarity on where we stand at this point. This particular article is entitled Obama's Libya Speech, Six Takeaways. In a primetime television address, the president lays out his rationale for intervening in Libya. Here, a concise summary of the ways his speech succeeded and failed. On Monday evening, President Obama took to the stage at National Defense University to lay out his case for America's bombing of Libya. In his half-hour nationally televised speech, Obama said he felt compelled to attack because Muammar Gaddafi was on the verge of massacring his own people, because Libyan rebels were asking for support, and because there was an international consensus to do so. Commentators immediately parsed his speech. Here are six key takeaways. Number one, Obama offered a rationale, a moral imperative. President Obama's womanlike effort to explain the why and how of his decision to bomb Libya boils down to this: because we could, and our interests and values demanded it, says Mark Ambinder in the National Journal. The president offered a moral imperative for U.S. action, placing America on the right side of history and Gaddafi on the wrong side, says Susan Brooks Thistlewaite in the Washington Post. The U.S. acted, he said, before the mass graves were dug. I have heard far worse arguments for the use of force. Number two. But he didn't exactly clarify the Obama doctrine. Anyone expecting the president to articulate an Obama doctrine was disappointed, says Ben Smith at Politico. The doctrine is there is no doctrine, or maybe even an anti-doctrine, that makes sure, above all, that one size never fits all. Nevertheless, Obama still laid out clear outlines for a muscular and unapologetic foreign policy, says Eugene Robinson in the Washington Post. Broadly, his version of a doctrine calls for humanitarian military intervention when it is both necessary and feasible. In other words, says Jim Garrity in National Review, it's look, just trust me on this. Number three takeaway, the neocons liked it. Obama's positively Kennedy-esque speech not only extolled American exceptionalism, says Robert Kagan in the Washington Post, it backed the U.S., or the use of U.S. power, to uphold our values. Indeed, I found Obama's words reassuring, says Bill Kristol in the Weekly Standard. His unapologetic freedom agenda, embracing, not shrinking from, the use of force speech, puts him back in the historical American foreign policy mainstream. Good grief, says Ala Pundit in Hot Air. If the conservative hawk Bill Kristol is praising the one's foreign policy speeches, I guess we're all neocons now. Takeaway number four, but not everyone was impressed. Unfortunately, Obama did not address the fact that the Libyan adventure is an undeclared war, says John Nichols in The Nation, and he barely mentioned Congress, which alone has the power to authorize such a military mission. Obama also addressed none of the calls for defining the mission's goals, duration, or cost, says Daniel Larrison in The Daily Beast. The public needed a forthright explanation and accounting of the risks that a Libyan war entails, and it received bromides instead. Takeaway number five, we're handing over control to NATO, sort of. Obama said the U.S. is handing all control of the mission over to NATO on Wednesday, says the Associated Press, But that just means turning the reins over to an organization dominated by the U.S., both militarily and politically. The commander of the operation will be a Canadian general, but his boss and his boss's boss will both be Americans. And the attack aircraft, refueling tankers and advanced military technology that made the U.S. the inevitable leader out of the gate, will continue to be in demand. And the final point, number six, in the end, this speech won't really matter. Obama's address wasn't commanding or inspiring enough to move public opinion, and it's not what people will remember, says Clive Crook in The Atlantic. If things go well, Gaddafi leaves or is made to leave, and the aftermath isn't too bloody, the operation will be deemed a success, and Obama will get much of the credit. If it turns into a bloody slog, Obama will certainly get the blame. And another story this week related to all of the problems in the Middle East. This one's entitled, Yemen's Regime Teeters. Beleaguered Yemeni President Ali Abdullah Saleh this week alternatively appealed for dialogue and threatened bloody civil war as his generals and diplomats deserted him. General Ali Moshin al-Amar, a key army commander and the president's half-brother, defected to anti-regime demonstrators, some 50 of whom were killed by government forces last week. As clashes intensified, Saleh's offer to step down by the end of the year had not appeased his opponents. He has one option, said opposition spokesman Mohammed Khatan, and it is to leave now, right now, without delaying and without conditions. Saleh, Yemen's ruler since 1978, is clinging to power by his fingertips, said Nick Bauman in MotherJones.com. But if he goes, Yemen could become a huge headache for the U.S. Saleh has been covering for the American military as it bombs and strafes al-Qaeda militants who have major strongholds in Yemen. Anwar al-Awlaki, the U.S.-born al-Qaeda propagandist who directly encouraged both the Fort Hood shooter and the underwear bomber, is hiding somewhere in Yemen's vast hinterland. Without Saleh, Yemeni cooperation with U.S. counterterrorism efforts will be totally up in the air. The entire country could descend into chaos, said Jacqueline Head in AlJazeera.com. Yemen, a fractious tribal country, has been riven by several civil wars since the 1960s. Because the opposition movement draws from many elements and is not spearheaded by a strong figurehead, war could break out even after Saleh goes. The U.S. and Saudi Arabia fear al-Qaeda could flourish even more if Yemen becomes a failed state. That is a likely outcome, said Daniel Byman in Slate.com. The best that could be hoped for is that one of the generals who defected this week will replace Saleh as a new dictator, balancing tribal and military power. But given the tribal tensions that have been simmering for decades, any new leader could well be even weaker than Saleh was. Yemen's future may be worse than its present. Now let's turn to the disaster in Japan, Japan's trials and tribulations. Japan struggled this week to care for victims of the tsunami and address its nuclear disaster. Workers made fitful progress toward cooling the stricken Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant, but tests revealed the tap water in Tokyo, 150 miles to the south, contained more than twice the iodine-131 levels considered safe for infants. Temporary shelters still hold more than 237,000 people, many of them sick. The official death toll from the disaster climbed to nearly 9,500, with more than 16,000 people still missing. And the government estimated the cost of damages at $309 billion, almost four times that of Hurricane Katrina in 2005. Technicians at Daiichi reconnected the plant to Japan's electrical grid, raising hopes that they could soon restore power to vital reactor cooling systems. But that process had to be suspended when steam and smoke began spewing from reactors 2 and 3. Technicians also sought to circulate cool water in pools containing spent fuel rods, which can release dangerous amounts of radiation if the water in the pools holding them boils away. Slow-to-arrive, spotty information from the Japanese government is spreading needless anxiety, said the Portland Oregonian. In events like this, anything less than real-time transparency is unacceptable. The information gap is a byproduct of Japan's plodding, consensus-oriented leadership style, said the Washington Post. If this crisis doesn't force the country's hidebound corporate and political leaders to adapt to 21st century standards of openness, what will? The media's disproportionate distorted reporting also foments needless worry, said Matthew Schaefer in NationalReview.com. Despite the scary headlines, the death toll from radiation as opposed to the earthquake or the tsunami will probably be minuscule. In fact, the most deadly consequence of the accident could be that it delays the advancement of nuclear technology. Curiously, it won't in Japan, said Gwen Dyer in the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. So long as the problems at Fukushima Daiichi do not kill large numbers of people, the Japanese will not abandon nuclear power. In the U.S. and Europe, meanwhile, a popular anti-nuclear reaction is underway, even though coal mining accidents and greenhouse gas emissions cause thousands more deaths every year. Many forget that even in the grimmest hour, risks should be assessed rationally and not emotionally. And now let's turn to the controversy of the week, according to The Week magazine. And the title of this article is Obama, Too Much Frivolity in Time of Crisis? With a question mark. Is this a good time for the president to be seen having a good time? Said Ron Smith in the Baltimore Sun. U.S. warplanes are bombing Libya as Muammar al-Qaddafi continues to slaughter his people. Yemen, Bahrain, and the rest of the Middle East are teetering on the brink. Japan is still reeling from one of the most damaging earthquakes in history and the resulting nuclear meltdown. And yet Barack Obama took some time off last week to go golfing, the 61st round of his presidency, and then taped a segment for ESPN announcing his picks for the NCAA basketball tournament. This week, Obama jumped on Air Force One with his family for a state visit to Brazil. I know this may sound churlish, but couldn't Obama give at least an appearance of involvement in the planet's multiple crises? Obama's ability to detach from reality is spectacular, said Jeannie DeAngelis at AmericanThinker.com. In addition to the global mess, he should be dealing with the broken U.S. economy, the battered housing market, and the ongoing congressional budget negotiations to reduce the federal deficit. But no, off to Rio he went. How nice that our president can still pursue an extravagant, elitist lifestyle, free from concern and adult responsibility. This is a common political attack, said Dan Amira in NewYorkMag.com. Just as Democrats blasted George W. Bush for clearing brush on his Texas ranch and Ronald Reagan for riding horses in California, the right is now savaging Obama for taking 9 minutes to share his March Madness brackets with the nation. In that brief TV appearance from the White House, not incidentally, Obama urged hundreds of thousands of ESPN viewers to donate to the Japan relief effort. This will have helped the people of Japan far more than if he'd canceled a brief segment for fear of superficially damaging optics. As for Obama's trip to Brazil, Chile, and El Salvador, said Mac Margolis in the DailyBeast.com, it is anything but a vacation. It's a bridge-building trip to prosperous Latin American nations, which the administration hopes could help revive the U.S. economy by importing more of our products. For Obama to make Brazil and job creation a diplomatic priority proves that he is doing his job, not that he isn't. The problem is not that Obama has a fondness for golf, said Kimberly Strassel in the Wall Street Journal, or for basketball or for foreign travel. The problem is that he has an aversion to making difficult or politically dangerous decisions. It seems he'd much rather be picking Kansas over Duke on ESPN than in the Oval Office deciding whether to back Libyan rebels against Qaddafi. The man's fatal addiction isn't to sports, it's to political safety. The presidency is a brutal job, said John Gordon, also in the Wall Street Journal, and criticizing Obama for an occasional golf round is a cheap shot. Most of Obama's predecessors found some solace and relaxation in diversions, too. FDR spent up to 2 hours a day on his stamp collection. Teddy Roosevelt left the White House to go hunting for days at a time. Dwight Eisenhower and John F. Kennedy played golf as often as they could. And why not? If the beleaguered leader of the free world can't lay down the terrible burdens of the office for an hour or two, he might not make the right tough choice when he absolutely needs to. And now, as we continue to read the Week magazine for this Friday, April 1st, 2011, let's go to the very popular feature of Good Week 4 and Bad Week 4. It was a good week for generosity after an unidentified man walked into a Boston Starbucks shouting, I'm rich," and tossed a blizzard of $1 bills in the air. Customers were so startled that they didn't grab the cash, which an employee donated to relief efforts in Japan. It was a good week for giving up drugs after former Van Halen guitarist Sammy Hagar claimed that aliens once visited him and plugged into me, changing him forever. They uploaded something from my brain, like an experiment. Hagar said it was real. And it was a good week for paying whatever the gas station charges after a house in Van Buren County, Michigan, was totally destroyed when two barrels of gasoline stored in the basement caught fire and exploded. The owner said she was stockpiling the gas because of rising prices. And it was a bad week for David Charles Schubert, the Las Vegas assistant district attorney who prosecuted Paris Hilton and singer Bruno Mars on cocaine charges after he was charged with buying crack cocaine himself. It was a bad week for President Obama after beauty expert Rebecca George said that Obama appeared 10 years older than he did when he took office. George said that not only is the 49-year-old president's hair grayer, but his face shows the telltale wrinkles and sunken mouth created by the stress hormone cortisol. And it was a bad week for crushes after a 92-year-old Florida woman fired 4 bullets at her 53-year-old neighbor's house and car when he refused her demand for a kiss. "I thought this only happened to younger people," sighed Dwight Bettner, the woman's target. And now let's turn to the section of the Week magazine entitled People. And it's always interesting. The first item this week is Allen's Absent Children. Woody Allen has always mined his own life for his work, says Carol Cadwalder in the London Observer. So it's curious that there are almost no children in his films. This despite the fact that he adopted 2 children and had a son with his ex-partner Mia Farrow, and has since adopted 2 more children with his current wife, Soon Yi. He brushes aside the idea that the absence of children in his work might be connected to his painful split with Farrow, after she discovered that he was involved with her adopted daughter, Soon Yi. "There were never children in my films," Allen says. "When I did Manhattan, I made a list at the end of the movie of the things that made life worth living, and I got a letter from a lady saying, 'You didn't mention your child.' Because I had a child in the movie, a young boy, I figured, so I didn't mention my child, so what? It was only when I had children, over a decade later, that I realized what an egregious blunder that was." So does he have any contact with his and Pharaoh's children? "Oh, contact with those children? No, I don't have contact with those children. I just have contact with my children." But that, he says, was the court's decision, not his. There are things in life that are terrible, and you get over it. You move on. The next article from the People section is Morris's Great Expectation. Jan Morris has spent 60 years traveling the globe, observing humanity and its works. But at age 74, the travel writer is afraid she might not live to see the most interesting thing of all. I have this strong feeling that we're on the brink of some colossal change, some cataclysmic, indeed cosmic change, she told John Walsh in the London Independent. Look at the world in the last 5 years, the pace of change at every level. The technology, Twitter, Facebook, the Internet, is so astonishing. It's unlike anything we've experienced before. I have reached the conclusion that what's going to happen is, she lets the dramatic tension build, we're going to discover very soon that we're not alone in this universe. Is she serious? We're going to discover there are sentient beings in the galaxy, she confirms. When it happens, the effects will be phenomenal. We'll have to start again, and it's going to happen, not in my lifetime, but in yours. When she tells people this, Morris says they think, she's bonkers. She's gone off her head. But I haven't. I believe in the sentient beings. But who they are and where they are, that's not my business. And the next item from the People, where Rodriguez got that attitude. Michelle Rodriguez owes her career to the Jehovah's Witnesses and Elaine Lipworth, or said Elaine Lipworth in the London Daily Mail. The actress, 32 years old, has made a career out of tough chick roles, a persona she developed growing up as a Dominican in Texas, whose family belonged to that proselytizing faith. My family was very strict. I went to church every day, and I go knocking on people's doors with my grandma trying to save their souls, she says. When word spread at school that she was different, trouble followed. A lot of people made fun of me, and I didn't like that, so I got into fights. She was expelled from 5 different schools for fighting and for questioning her teachers. As a Jehovah's Witness, I was learning about the history of the world and current affairs, and I absorbed everything. So when I was at school and they were teaching American history, I thought they were liars. She's since left the faith, but the feistiness she developed defending it helped her land her first acting gig, playing a female boxer. I told them I had no acting experience whatsoever, but I could kick every girl's ass in the room, she says. I beat 350 girls in order to get that role. And you're listening to our reading of The Week magazine for Friday, April 1st, 2011. Now we're going to turn to the popular section entitled The Briefing. This particular one for this week is called Aid to the World. The budget debate has sharpened scrutiny of U.S. foreign aid. Are we getting our money's worth? Why do we send money to foreign countries? The U.S. government cites 2 reasons, national security and humanitarian concerns. The top aid recipients are strategically important countries where the U.S. wants to safeguard vital economic interests, counter Al-Qaeda, or staunch the flow of drugs. Economic development is a lot cheaper than sending soldiers, Secretary of Defense Robert Gates said recently. Aid flows as well in smaller quantities to the poorest of the poor in sub-Saharan Africa, where the focus is on food and medical assistance and the fight against AIDS. How much do we spend on foreign aid? Far less than we think. Polls have consistently found that Americans believe around a quarter of the U.S. budget goes to foreign aid, and respondents say we ought to spend at most half that much. In fact, foreign aid accounts for about 1.1% of the budget, or $39.4 billion, and a quarter of that is military aid. In absolute terms, the U.S. is the world's most generous country, but as a percentage of national income, our foreign aid budget is stingier than that of any wealthy country but South Korea. Great Britain and France each spend about twice the rate of the United States, where foreign aid outlays come to less than 40 cents per citizen per day. Where does it all go? Egypt and Israel have traditionally been among the top aid recipients, but since 9/11, foreign aid budgets have tripled and shifted, especially toward Afghanistan and Pakistan. Afghanistan in 2009 received the largest amount, more than $3 billion in economic assistance and $5.7 billion in military assistance. Some of that money flows straight to Afghan government institutions in the form of cash, and many suspect that some of it flows out the same way. WikiLeaks revealed a U.S. embassy's cable stating that an Afghan vice president had been discovered in 2009 transporting $52 million in cash to Dubai. Another cable detailed how the governor of one province skimmed funds from U.S. development projects by threatening contractors until they gave him cash. Is waste like that an exception? Yes, but there are nagging questions. A Brookings Institution report last year found that the U.S. ranked worst of all international donors in following up on who exactly receives its money. Definitions of waste differ, too. Representative Ron Paul, for example, opposes all foreign aid, calling it a doomed attempt to purchase friends. Others argue that even when U.S. dollars go to a good cause, they allow unscrupulous rulers to waste money in other ways. Republican Representative Ed Royce complained last month that the government had given $540 million to Senegal, which in turn spent $28 million of its own money on a bombastic African Renaissance monument larger than the Statue of Liberty and built by North Koreans. Our U.S. taxpayers put money into Senegal, and that frees up money for this kind of an operation, Royce said. On the other hand, U.S. funding to Senegal and other poor countries unquestionably saves lives, and there is no compelling evidence that foreign aid is any more prone to waste than, say, military expenditures are. Will Congress cut foreign aid? It aims to. Kay Granger, the Texas Republican who chairs the House subcommittee that appropriates funds for foreign aid, promises painful cuts to programs that don't affect direct national security, especially expenditures for food and climate change programs. She's backing a bill to cut $121 million, about 9% of the budget of the U.S. Agency for International Development, even as she acknowledges a huge misunderstanding on the part of people who believe that cuts to such spending can resolve budget deficits. Republicans contend that with Americans out of work and the country deeply in debt, the U.S. can no longer afford to provide handouts. Is there pushback? Plenty, including from the Pentagon. General David Petraeus, commander of U.S. and NATO forces in Afghanistan, warned Congress last month that inadequate resourcing of our civilian partners could jeopardize accomplishment of the overall mission. Others contend that foreign aid to poor countries is not only a moral imperative, but also a small investment that yields a huge payoff. The 1% we spend on aid for the poorest not only saves millions of lives, says Microsoft founder Bill Gates, it has an enormous impact on developing economies, which means it has an impact on our economy. And the footnote to Aid to the World in this briefing at the Week magazine, Aid to Fight AIDS. Even people who are snide and snarky about the United States of America have to admit that millions and millions of lives have been saved by American taxpayers, Rockstar Bono told Fox News last year. He and other development activists have particularly praised former President George W. Bush for launching a multi-year, multi-billion dollar commitment to fight AIDS in Haiti, Guyana, Vietnam, and 12 African countries. In its first 5 years, the program spent nearly $20 billion to purchase and distribute antiretroviral drugs to some 2 million HIV-positive people. More than half of them were pregnant women. Thanks to the drugs, nearly 250,000 babies born to HIV-positive mothers were HIV-free. And over the first 5 years, the AIDS death rate in those countries dropped by more than 10%. I was acting on national security concerns, Bush said. There's nothing more hopeless than for a child to watch mom and dad die of AIDS and nobody helped, particularly the wealthy nations. And the enemy we face can only recruit when they find hopeless people. And now from the Week magazine, let's take a look at what the Week calls the best columns from the United States this past week. The first one is entitled The Backward Legacy of Progressism, and it's written by Stephen Goldsmith from the Wall Street Journal. Progressive government is obsolete, said New York City Deputy Mayor Stephen Goldsmith. A century ago, progressives created a system of rigid civil service rules to block the cronyism and corruption in city and state governments. The goal was to protect the least fortunate members of society from the abuses of the rich and powerful. While that was still necessary then, the pendulum has swung too far in the opposite direction. And now civil service rules and public unions are the enemy of the public and the poor. In New York City, seniority rules force us to base any layoffs on when a public worker was hired, not on whether he or she does a good job. That makes dismissing bad apples in the Big Apple all but impossible, including bad teachers dragging down public schools. Faced with huge budget shortfalls, the city must simultaneously pour $8.4 billion from its operating budget to fill a hole in employee pension obligations. The result? Less money for hospital care, homeless shelters, and cops for crime-ridden neighborhoods. We need a new approach to governance, focused on a skilled, productive workforce and less red tape. True progress does not lie in preserving a wasteful status quo, but in delivering real value to the public with every tax dollar. Our next column is entitled America Has Angry Young People Too, by Matthew C. Klein in the New York Times. The young people of the Arab world aren't alone in their despair and anger, said Matthew Klein. As a 24-year-old American, I can tell you that even though we live in an affluent democracy, my generation is losing its faith in the future. The unemployment rate among those 24 and under is 21%, not far below Egypt's. Many of those without a job are like a friend of mine, a brilliant guy who studied Chinese and international relations at a top-tier college, but wound up in unpaid internships and making minimum wage as a lifeguard. Unable to pay his rent, he moved back in with his parents. Even if the economy improves, and we do find good jobs someday, young people know that we'll be responsible for paying off the huge budget deficits run up by our parents, who'll be off collecting their entitlement benefits while programs for young people are cut. It may be hard to imagine an Egyptian-style revolution in a rich democracy, but watch out. The American dream is unavailable to my generation, and our frustration is growing. The next column in the Week magazine this week is entitled, Let's Really Give Peace a Chance. It was written by Coleman McCarthy in the Washington Post. Let's kill the U.S. Institute of Peace, said Coleman McCarthy. The Republican House has voted to cut the $43 million in annual funds provided to the Institute, created by Congress in 1984, to promote peace throughout the world. As an advocate of peace, I fully support putting this doomed agency out of its misery. While the Institute's mediators have done some good work in conflict zones around the globe, it has been hamstrung by the start from Congress's demand that it never ever criticize any war involving the U.S. It is therefore an agency with all gums and no teeth. It can say nothing about the endless wars in Iraq and Afghanistan or the U.S.'s long-standing support of oppressive dictators. Most of the Institute's bipartisan board of directors are political appointments, corporate executives, academics, and party loyalists. No Christian pacifists, anti-war activists, or agitators are welcome. Their mission? Sit in the boat, don't rock it. Instead of continuing this demeaning farce, the Institute should go private and pursue real funding from donors so it can freely advocate nonviolence instead of turning a blind eye to any kind of war. Now from the Week magazine, let's turn to the section entitled The Last Word. And the last word for this week is entitled After the Apocalypse, 25 years after the meltdown at Chernobyl, says Henry Shuckman, an irradiated Eden is coming to life. The wild boar is standing 30 or 40 yards away at the bottom of a grassy bank, staring right at me. Even from this distance, I can see its outrageously long snout, its giant pointed ears, and the spiny bristles along its back. And it's far bigger than I expected, maybe chest-high to a man. For a moment it seems to consider charging me, then thinks better of it. When it trots away, it moves powerfully, smoothly, on spindly, graceful legs, twice as long as a pig's, and vanishes into the trees. I climb back into our VW van, tingling all over. This is northern Ukraine's Chernobyl exclusion zone, a huge area some 60 miles across in places that's been off-limits to human habitation since 1986. At the Chernobyl Center, a kind of makeshift reception building in the heart of the old town, I have to hand over a solid 9 inches of local bills, hryvnia, pronounced approximately like the sound of a card sharp rifling a deck, sign a stack of agreements, compliances, and receipts, and then get checked on an Austin Powers-style Geiger counter made out of chrome. Finally, under the protection of a guide, a driver, and an interpreter, my photographer and I are free to set off into the zone, as long as we do exactly what our guide says. A handful of dilapidated roads cross the zone, half overgrown with weeds and grasses, and the whole area is littered with pockets of intense radiation. But nature doesn't seem to mind. The zone is reverting to one big untamed forest, and it all sounds like a fantastic success story for nature. Remove the humans, and the wilderness bounces right back. Lured by tales of mammals unknown in Europe since the Dark Ages, we are setting out on an atomic safari. It was soon after 1 a.m. on the night of April 26, 1986, that one of the world's nightmare scenarios unfolded. Reactor 4 in the huge Chernobyl power station blew up. The causes are still the subject of debate, but it was some combination of a design flaw involving the control rods that regulate reactor power levels, a poorly trained engineering crew, a test that required a power down of the reactor, and a dogged old-style Soviet boss who refused to believe that anything major could go wrong. At any rate, it was spectacular. 800-pound cubes of lead were tossed around like popcorn. The 1,000-ton ceiling cap was blown clear off the reactor. A stream of raspberry-colored light shone up into the night sky, ionized air so beautiful that inhabitants of the nearby city of Pripyat came out to stare. When it was all over, estimates former deputy chief engineer Grigory Medvedev, the radioactive release was 10 times that of Hiroshima. 30 people died on the night of the explosion or soon after. 2 days later, a convoy of 1,100 buses shipped out all the inhabitants of Pripyat, turning it into a ghost city overnight. In the following weeks, bureaucrats in Moscow designated an 1,100-square-mile exclusion zone, roughly the size of Yosemite, reasoning that the farther from Chernobyl people were, the better. Today, around 5,000 people work in the exclusion zone, which is over the years has grown to an area of 1,660 square miles. For one thing, you can't just switch off a nuclear power plant. Even decommissioned, it requires maintenance, as does the new nuclear waste storage facility on site. The workers come in for two-week shifts and receive 3 times the normal pay. There are also some 300 people living in the zone, villagers who've been coming home to their old farming lands since not long after the disaster, and teams of radiologists from around the world who've come to study the effects of radioactive fallout on plants and animals. They've effectively turned the zone into a giant radiation lab, a place where the animals are mostly undisturbed, living amid a pre-industrial number of humans and a post-apocalyptic amount of radioactive strontium and cesium. On the outside, the fauna seems to be thriving. There have been huge resurgences in the numbers of large mammals, including gray wolves, brown bears, elk, roe deer, and wild boars present in quantities not recorded for more than a century. The question scientists are trying to answer is, what's happening on the inside, in their bones, and in their very DNA? Once you enter the zone, the quiet is a shock. It would be eerie were it not so lovely. The abandoned back streets of Chernobyl are so overgrown you can hardly see that it's a town. They've turned into dark green tunnels, buzzing with bees filled with an orchestral score of birdsong, the lanes so narrow that the van pushes aside weeds on both sides as it creeps down them, passing house after house enshrined in forest. Red admirals, peacock butterflies, and some velvety brown Lepidoptera are fluttering all over the vegetation. It looks like something out of an old Russian fairy tale. Ukraine officially opened Chernobyl up to tourism in January of 2011, but small groups have been able to visit the zone for the past few years. There are small tour operators based in Kiev that take visitors on day trips. You don't need Geiger counters or special suits. You just have to stay with the tour, pass through several checkpoints, and get tested for radiation on your way out. The tours will shuttle you around some of the main sites, the deserted city of Pripyat, a small park filled with old Soviet Army vehicles used in the cleanup, various concrete memorials to the fire crews who lost their lives after the blast. The most contaminated of the villages were bulldozed and buried soon after the explosion, with only a few mounds and ridges left to show that they were ever even there. The meadows are mostly gone, replaced by forest. Russia is a land of forests, but the true forest, the primeval untouched forest that human eyes may never even have seen, is called Pushka, which roughly translates as dense forest. This is what has been reestablishing itself at Chernobyl, regenerating at an unprecedented rate. At the edge of Chernobyl, we stop by the half-mile-wide Ripyat River. It's unbelievably peaceful. Frogs plop into the water. Dragonflies hover. It's like a weight has been lifted from the world. The main sounds are the different shades of hissing of wind in the trees, high nearby, deeper and steadier farther away. This must be what life was like 1,000 years ago, when the entire human population of the globe was roughly 250 million. Our tour guide, Sergei, tells us about the herds of boars he has seen, 50 strong rampaging through the forest, and about a starving wolf pack that surrounded a scientist friend of his in a wood one winter day. He had to shoot every last one to get away. Is this the world before humanity or after? Is there a difference? Well, today there are around 5,000 adult wild boars in the exclusion zone. In 1995, there were many more, but they suffered an epidemic and have now stabilized. There are 25 to 30 wolf packs, a total of maybe 180 adults. Many more lynx live here than before, along with foxes, barsooks, which is a Ukrainian badger, hundreds of red deer and thousands of roe deer and elk. Out of the disaster comes a paradise of wildlife. The Garden of Eden is regenerating. But it's not so straightforward. For 17 years, biologist Igor Shishovsky has been studying how animals metabolize cesium and strontium. On the surface, Igor says the wildlife seems to be thriving, but under the fur and hide, the DNA of most species has become unstable. They've eaten a lot of food contaminated with cesium and strontium. Even though the animals look fine, there are differences at the chromosomal level in every generation, as yet mostly invisible. But some have started to show. There are bird populations with freakishly high levels of albinism, with 20% higher levels of asymmetry in their feathers and higher cancer rates. Covered in radioactive particles after the disaster, one large pine forest turned from green to red. Some birch trees have grown in the shape of large bushy feathers without a recognizable trunk at all. Genomes are unpredictable, says Igor. Genome not exactly same from generation to generation. They change. No one knows what these changes could result in. Sooner or later, Igor says, new species will evolve. In other words, new animals could actually be in the making here. The area has become a laboratory of microevolution, very rapid evolution, says Igor, but no one knows what will emerge or when. Visiting the exclusion zone is like staring down the barrel of our likely fate. We may wipe ourselves out with a nuclear holocaust or with carbon and methane or some other way we can't yet conceive of. Cyanobacteria poisoned their own atmosphere 2.5 billion years ago by releasing vast quantities of a gas that was poisonous to them, oxygen, and in the process created an atmosphere suited to higher forms of land life. Who knows what creatures may adapt to a high-carbon, high-methane atmosphere if we keep going the way we are? They may not include us, or they may not include us, or they may. We don't know. We drive on to the old power station itself. It's a large area of vast concrete buildings. One of them is Stricken Reactor No. 4, some 200 feet tall, with a giant chimney still rising out from it. For almost 25 years, it stood encased in a sarcophagus of cement. But the seal is far from perfect, and it leaks dangerously. There are canals threading through the giant buildings, which provided water for the old coolant system, and in one of the catfish have grown to a prodigious sizes. We stop on a metal bridge and gaze down into the brown river. Suddenly the monsters rise to the surface, some of them a good 10 feet long, black, whiskered, curling around as they hunt for the bread people feed them. They're not big because of radiation, Sergei insists. It's just that they haven't been fished for a quarter of a century. The whole area is like this, fecund scary. Later, Sergei takes us to an army barracks where some soldier friends of his keep a few wild pets. From the dark doorway of one of the sheds issues a terrific subterranean grunt, and a moment later, as if in a hurry, out trots another wild boar. It comes straight at the fence, presses against it with the weird, wet sucker of its long, long nose, then raises its bristly head and eyeballs me as if I'm something from another planet. In a pen next door, there's another forest sprite, the barsook, a very close relative of our badger. When it comes out of its kennel, it runs up a woodpile, turns at the top, and proceeds to stare right into me with deeply strange eyes. Something in me seems to recognize something in it, and I feel a pang of longing. Is it for the deep forest, the pushka? For the trees, the smell of autumn leaves, of mushrooms and mold? For the freedom to live our own way, far from society? Crouching and staring, the barsook doesn't move a muscle. It could be a stuffed animal with eyes of glass. Or perhaps a new species staring at the world with new eyes. And that was by Henry Schuckman from a longer article that appears in Outside Magazine. Used with permission, and all rights are reserved. As we reach the end of our program, we have time for a few more articles here. Let's turn to the Health and Science section from the Week magazine for this week. Our first item is entitled, Coffee Could Head Off Strokes. Maybe good news for you. Enjoying a second cup of coffee in the morning could lower your risk of stroke, a new study has found. Researchers at Sweden's Karolinska Institute tracked nearly 35,000 women ages 49 to 83 over 10 years and discovered that those who drank more than one cup of coffee per day were 22 to 25% less likely to suffer a stroke than those who drank less. Coffee drinkers should rejoice. Sharon N. Hayes, a cardiologist at the Mayo Clinic, tells the Associated Press, if you are drinking coffee now, you may be doing some good and you're likely not doing harm. The study isn't the first to attribute a significant health benefit to coffee. Other reports have shown it may help prevent mental decline, improve heart health, and reduce the risk of liver cancer. Study author Susanna Larson suggests the antioxidants in coffee might reduce the kinds of inflammation and cell damage that can lead to stroke, but other experts caution that no cause and effect link has yet been established. Coffee is one of the most popular beverages in the world, Larson notes, so even if it turns out to have only small health effects, they could have large public health consequences. West Coast residents fearing radiation from Japan's damaged nuclear reactors brought up all available supplies of potassium iodide pills. The pills, which officials say are utterly unnecessary for Americans 5,000 miles from the nuclear accident, protect against the absorption of radioactive iodine by the thyroid gland. Those who don't get it are crying, said the owner of one company which sold 10,000 boxes of pills in a single day. Women still got 91% of all cosmetic surgeries in 2010, but men, particularly aging baby boomers, are showing up at plastic surgeons' offices in growing numbers. The number of male facelifts increased 14%, while Botox treatments for men rose 9% to 336,000 just last year. Cats kill about 500 million birds a year in the United States, more than 1,000 times the number of birds killed by power-generating wind turbines. The American Bird Conservancy says it's time to stop minimizing and trivializing the impacts that outdoor cats have on the environment. About 75 professional lobbyists have been hired in top policy-making staff positions by Republican members of Senate and House committees. The House Energy and Commerce Committee, which is drafting legislation sought by the oil and energy industries, has hired four staffers who worked for those industries just last year. And that item from the Washington Post. Now let's take a look at our poll watch for this week. And you may not believe this one, but here it goes. If given the choice between Charlie Sheen and Sarah Palin for president, 44% of Democratic voters say they'd choose Sheen, while 24% say that they would vote for Palin. If given a choice between Sheen and President Obama, 37% of Republicans say they'd vote for Sheen, while 28% would reluctantly opt for the president. Now a couple of words of wit and wisdom from the Week magazine as we close out our program. He who is in love with himself has at least this advantage: he won't have many rivals. That was from scientist George Christoph Lichtenberg, and he was quoted in Forbes magazine. Never think you've seen the last of anything, Eudora Welty said, and she was quoted in the Buffalo News. And those who say they give the public what it wants begin by underestimating public taste and ending by debauching it. That was said by T.S. Eliot, who had been quoted in the Associated Press. Well, we've just about run out of time for today's episode of the Week magazine. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm George Douglas, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The program is readily available as a podcast right after the broadcast. So long until next time.